This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Political and military alliances are getting redrawn according to who has oil and gas and who needs it. Michael Clare calls this the new international energy order. He says in this new order, Russia, once the bruised, battered, poverty-stricken loser of the Cold War, has emerged as an imperious power broker of Eurasian energy supplies. The U.S., not long ago billed as the world's unchallenged superpower, has become distressingly dependent on foreign oil suppliers, who, in President Bush's words, do not share our interests. China and India are rising economic giants competing with older powers for energy resources. Michael Clare is the author of the new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. He's the defense analyst for The Nation and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. Russia is very rich in oil right now and is doing quite well economically because of it, oil and gas. So is that creating a stronger connection between the United States and Russia or driving us further apart?
Well, this has been a big disappointment for the Bush administration, Terry. When the Soviet Union broke apart and Boris Yeltsin was president, American companies saw a great prospect of developing Russian oil and gas and bringing that to this country. And American companies did develop contracts for the development of oil and gas projects, especially off of Russia's far eastern coast, off of Sakhalin Island. But when Vladimir Putin moved in to replace Boris Yeltsin, he took a much more jaundiced look at American companies developing these resources. Nonetheless, President Bush made a strenuous effort in the months after 9/11 to forge an energy partnership with Vladimir Putin. He met with him several times and forged what was called the U.S.-Russian Energy Partnership. And there was talk of close cooperation between the two countries. Sad to say, all of this has come to naught because Putin has made a very vigorous effort to take possession, repossess all of these assets that were privatized by Yeltsin and bring them under state control, really to make Gazprom, the state-owned natural gas monopoly, the central mechanism of control over all of Russia's oil and gas assets. And American companies have more or less been frozen out of Russian energy assets. And so none of these endeavors by President Bush have gone anywhere, and it doesn't look very promising for the future. European companies have also found a very disappointing prospects. Shell was lost its majority ownership of the Sakhalin 2 project. BP is finding a very difficult time. So this hasn't proved very successful endeavor.
So as the United States and European countries are being shut out by Russia, what are some of the countries that Russia is forming alliances with because of energy?
Well, this is really what I highlight in my book, the changing landscape of world energy. The older energy powers, mainly the Western countries, the United States, Europe, and Japan, which once dominated the world energy trade, are now being shoved aside by state-owned companies in the oil-producing countries, Russia and the Middle Eastern countries and Venezuela and now the African countries. Their state-owned companies, known as national oil companies or NOCs, are forming partnerships among them. So the Russian companies, Gazprom, and other state-owned companies are forming alliances with state-owned companies in the Middle East, with Iran, and in some cases with Chinese companies. There's talk now of a natural gas OPEC among the natural gas producers. Russia is the world's leading natural gas producer. Iran is number two. Qatar is number three. And there have been talk among them to form a OPEC-like cartel of these leading natural gas producers. This represents a real shift in the world balance of power between the older energy producers and these new state-controlled oil-producing companies.
The companies that have nationalized their oil industries and now have like state-run oil industries, are these countries not only forming energy alliances with each other, are they forming military alliances with each other? And if so, what are a couple of the most significant ones?
Yes, they certainly are forming military as well as energy alliances. Perhaps the most interesting example of this is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO. This is an alliance forged by China and Russia in 1996, and it includes those two countries, plus the Central Asian states of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. Most of these countries are energy producers, Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, and this has a security dimension. They are all pledged to cooperate with one another in opposing terrorism and foreign enemies, but it's also designed to cooperate in energy security and protecting their energy infrastructure. And it's a vehicle for supplying weapons to these countries and to cooperate in defending their very vulnerable pipelines. And it has become increasingly militarized and anti-American. They've adopted a call for the United States to abandon its bases in the area and to stay out. This is a very disturbing development.
At the risk of asking the obvious, what's the most disturbing aspects of it?
What I find disturbing about this is the degree to which energy on a global scale is taking on a kind of a Cold War element, that the U.S., China, and Russia are viewing energy as the basis of a global power struggle. It's not just in Central Asia, it's in the Middle East and in Africa. Just this year, the United States created the U.S. Africa Command, the first new overseas regional command to be developed in 25 years since the Central Command was created in the Middle East. And that command was established after Russia invaded Afghanistan, and it was created for the purpose of protecting Middle East oil. Now we have a new Africa Command, and its purpose, I believe, is to protect African oil against the growing presence in Africa of the Chinese and their pursuit of African oil. The military won't say this, Terry. You know, if you ask them, they'll deny that. But I think if you look at the history of the formation of this new command, it reflects growing concern about America's dependence on African oil.
So where does Iran figure into the new energy alliances that are being formed now?
As you know, Terry, the United States is deeply concerned about Iran's looming military presence in the Persian Gulf. Iran is also a major energy supplier. It has the second largest reserves of oil and natural gas in the world, and it is a major supplier of oil to China. And it is majorly dependent on Russia as a supplier of arms, and Vladimir Putin was recently in Iran and promised to increase its supply of arms to Iran. And China has been supplying Iran with missiles and missile technology. So this is an indication, again, of how these energy relationships are increasingly being militarized.
One of your concerns is that because energy relationships are becoming increasingly militarized, that an accidental war, an inadvertent war, might break out. What kind of scenario do you have in mind?
I think very much of the period before World War I, when the major world powers were jockeying for influence in some of the same areas of the world, by the way, in Central Asia and Africa, for geopolitical influence. And they became deeply involved in local conflicts and again were providing arms and advisors and deploying troops and got overly involved in these disputes, and these local conflicts provided the sparks for clashes between the forces of the opposing sides. That's what I worry about, that you could have American and Russian or American and Chinese troops caught up overnight, inadvertently, in a local dispute without anybody really planning for this to happen. We have troops in Kyrgyzstan. We have troops in Georgia within miles of Russian bases, almost in sighting distance of Russian bases. And both of those countries have the potential for ethnic wars that could blow up overnight and inadvertently trigger a shooting match between U.S. and Russian troops. Nobody would plan for this, but it could happen.
My guest is Michael Clare. He's the author of the new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. And he's the defense correspondent for The Nation and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Clare, and he's written a new book called Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. He's a defense correspondent for The Nation and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. You've talked a little bit about the national oil companies, the countries that have nationalized their oil industries. Now, the United States certainly hasn't done that. On the other hand, you point out that the United States has increasingly politicized its energy policy.
Militarized.
Okay, give me an example of what you mean.
Well, I talk about the formation of AFRICOM in Africa, the new U.S. military command for the African continent. We are supplying increasing amounts of military assistance to Nigeria, to Angola, to Equatorial Guinea, to other oil-producing countries in Africa. And when you look at the congressional justification for why we're doing it, the Pentagon and the Bush administration say it's because we're fearful that unrest and insurgency in Africa will threaten the supply of oil to the United States. An area of particular concern is the Niger Delta region of Nigeria, where there is a very active insurgency underway. Nigeria is expected to be the leading supplier of oil in Africa to the United States, possibly the leading supplier of oil from anywhere in the world to the United States. So the fact that there's a insurgency there is of great concern, and we're increasingly helping the Nigerian government to suppress that insurgency.
I want to talk to you about Venezuela a little bit.
Sure.
I think it's hard for people in the United States to think about how powerful Venezuela has become, largely because of its oil. And Venezuela is one of the countries that has a national oil company. It's mostly state-run. How is oil affecting Venezuela's power?
Venezuela's power stems from both its oil. Remember, Venezuela is still one of the major suppliers of oil to the United States, despite all of the bad language that gets hurled back and forth between our two countries. Venezuela still provides us with about 1.5 million barrels of oil a day, and we rely on that. But it's also the money. The high price of oil has given Hugo Chavez billions of dollars that he can use to influence politics in Latin America and in his own country. He's used it for social programs that has given him great popularity in his country. And he's also supported social programs throughout Latin America that has equaled or exceeded the kind of aid that the United States provides. So he looks very appealing to many people in Latin America at a time when the United States does not look very appealing. So it's both the oil and the money that oil provides.
Meanwhile, Hugo Chavez hates President Bush. I said incredibly insulting things about him. So where do you see the relationship headed now between the United States and Venezuela, and how does that affect our future using their oil?
The fact is that both the U.S. and Venezuela are mutually dependent on each other. That's the odd fact. It's like a dysfunctional marriage, and neither one of us can afford to sever that relationship. It would be devastating for Venezuela, and it would be devastating for the United States, maybe less for us than for them. But even so, given the high price of oil today and the need for every single barrel of oil that we can get our hands on, neither of us wants to break that relationship. So I would imagine, especially if there's a Democratic president in a year from now, that efforts will be made to get some marriage counseling.
5 years after the United States invaded Iraq, I'm wondering what you think now in terms of how much oil figured into the motivation behind the invasion.
Well, I've always said, Terry, that the invasion of Iraq was not about Iraq's oil per se, as some people have claimed. Instead, that it was consistent with the Carter Doctrine of 1980, which says that it is in America's vital interests to dominate the Persian Gulf region and protect the flow of oil from the entire region in order to make sure that the United States and its allies have access to that area's oil, which is two-thirds of the world's oil, and that Saddam Hussein posed a threat, a serious threat, to control of the entire area. And this is exactly what Dick Cheney said at the time before the invasion, that armed with weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein would pose a threat to the free flow of oil and therefore had to be removed. And I think that George Bush believes that that's what he accomplished in Iraq.
So how do you think the war 5 years after it started is affecting the free flow of oil in the region?
I would say that it's mixed results. From that perspective alone, it's mixed results. You have eliminated one of the regimes that posed a potential threat. On the other hand, you've created a black hole of instability and chaos that could potentially create threats of ethnic warfare and religious warfare that could spread to the other countries in the form of sabotage to oil facilities. So I think the results are mixed.
The Navy, the U.S. Navy, is establishing a command and control facility on top of an offshore Iraqi oil platform in the Persian Gulf. What's the purpose of this?
This facility is to protect the loading facilities. This is in Basra, and just recently, as you know, the government of Prime Minister al-Maliki attempted to clear the port area of militias and other hostile elements. The Basra is the main port for the export of Iraqi oil, and there's been a lot of criminal and militia activity that has severely disrupted the export of Iraqi oil. And so this command and control facility you're referring to is part of an effort by the U.S. and the Iraqi government to protect future exports of Iraqi oil against sabotage, theft, corruption, and all of the rest. Americans may not be aware that a lot of the losses of Iraqi oil is not to insurgency, but to theft and corruption.
There was an article recently in the New York Times that at least one-third of the fuel from Iraq's largest refinery is being diverted to the black market. And this is according to American military officials. Tankers are being hijacked, drivers bribed, papers forged, meters manipulated, and some of the money's going to insurgents.
That's right. The current situation in Iraq is one in which the insurgency has been to some degree contained, but the degree of lawlessness and corruption is so great, and the oil industry, of course, is the only source of wealth in this country. There is no other source of wealth. So there's tremendous fighting between the different factions over who will control the revenues generated by oil and who controls the flow from the refineries to the gas stations and all of that, some of it is very violent. And that's what the fighting in Basra was really all about.
About oil?
About control over the black market trade. Who's going to control it? Is the Iraqi government going to control it? Is this militia going to control it? Is Sadr's militia going to control it? It's really inter-warlord corruption.
Michael Clare will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet: The New Geopolitics of Energy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Clare. His new book is about how political and military alliances are getting redrawn according to who has oil and who needs it. He calls this the new international energy order. His new book is called Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet: The New Geopolitics of Energy. Clare is the defense correspondent for The Nation and the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst. Let me bring up China here. China has been so much in the news now because of the Olympics and the crackdown on Tibet. China has a huge population. It really needs a lot of energy. What about China as an energy supplier? Does it have much energy resources within its own country?
Well, this is the great challenge and for the entire planet. China does have one source of energy in abundance, and that's coal. China is the world's leading user of coal, and it intends to use much more coal in the future. By the year 2030, it's expected that China will use half of the world's coal. And unfortunately, China intends to use, kind of primitive, by modern standards, primitive coal-burning facilities to generate electricity. And if this continues to be the case, we are all hostage on the planet to China's coal use, because this will be the leading source of greenhouse gas producing carbon dioxide emissions. And there will be no hope of averting the worst global climate change disasters. So we have all got to work with China. This is really a catastrophic phenomenon. We have got to work with China to either abandon its reliance on coal or to adopt more modern, less, carbon dioxide emitting coal facilities.
You literally think that the United States should be doing some kind of joint project with China to develop alternative energy. What are the odds of something like that actually happening?
Well, we used to think, Terry, of national security, meaning, building up nuclear weapons for a possible war with China. We have to think of our national security as working with China not to burn coal at the rate they're doing, because our survival on the planet is at risk from this. And if we grasp this reality, yes, I think that we will understand the necessity of cooperating with China in developing energy alternatives. It's a matter of survival.
We've been talking about energy and how it's realigning political and military connections around the world. Gas has risen about 80% at the pumps in the past year. And, the oil companies have recently made huge profits. What's the correlation between the rise in gas prices and the profits at the energy companies? Is it the profits that's behind the rise in prices? Is it something else?
The rise in gasoline prices, Terry, are really a combination of factors. Partly, it's simply the fact that the production of oil is not keeping pace with worldwide demand. But on top of that, you have the fact that the oil companies, the private oil companies, which no longer produce much of the world's oil in comparison to the state-owned oil companies, now are mainly in the business of selling oil, of refining it, distributing it, and marketing it. and they're the beneficiaries of the rising price of crude oil. They take the profit off of the rising price of crude. They then double that in the refining and distribution and marketing part of the process, and they get all of the profit from that.
You know, your book is called Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, and one of the main points of the book is that there's a greater and greater demand for oil and gas as countries, huge countries like India and China, become more and more industrialized, and there's more demand for cars and automobiles. And at the same time, energy supplies are shrinking. So what kind of recipe is that creating?
Well, I think this is what's really behind the rising prices we see at the pump, for example, because all of a sudden you have hundreds of millions of new consumers in China and India who are buying their first car, and they're buying gasoline-powered cars. So there's a huge increase in demand. Well, that's half the equation, Terry. The other half is the fact that the oil companies are searching for new oil fields to satisfy all of this demand, and they're not finding any. We're just not finding giant new oil fields like the ones that we found in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, like the Mammoth Gawar oil field in Saudi Arabia that still produces a very large supply of world demand. We're not finding these new oil fields. So the world supply is not keeping pace with demand, and that's pushing up the price of oil. And this appears to be the trend for as far as we could see into the future, which means these higher prices are likely to persist indefinitely.
Well, Michael Clare, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry, always.
Michael Clare is the author of the new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet.